From PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston, CA. There are few remaining communist states in the world today. One of them, Cuba, is in this hemisphere and has been in a tense confrontation with the United States for nearly four decades. That tension and the central importance of one man, Fidel Castro, to Cuban politics underscores growing speculation about what lies ahead for the island nation. One thing is certain, the collapse or continuance of the Cuban regime will rest largely upon that nation's economic performance. My guest today is Richard Kaufman, a fellow of the Woodrow Wilson Center, where he's currently working on economic intelligence and Cold War policy. Richard, welcome back to Dialogue.
Well, thank you, George. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you back and glad to talk about this topic. It occurred to me, Richard, thinking about it, that if you and I were sort of transported back in time and were meeting in the early 60s to talk about Cuba and its economy, it'd be a very different conversation. And so I thought to sort of establish a basis, I'd like to ask you a question about that early period. In the early 1960s, it seems to me there were at least a couple of things going on in the Cuban economy. The start of collectivization, of course, and then the appropriation of American business interests. Could you give us a sort of a quick sense of what Cuba's economy was like in that period and with those forces at play?
Castro had come to power just a few years before and had overturned a very authoritarian right-wing dictatorship ruled by a dictator named Batista. His was a popular, populist uprising, which he led in a very intensive and sustained effort that displayed his physical courage and his initial idealism. Once in power, however, he made a wrong turn. His relations with the United States were, I suppose, irreparably harmed by his decision to expropriate Western businesses, including America's. And this was done in violation of all international norms. Country always has the right to take over foreign holdings or any other holdings when it's in its national interests, but it must do it with reasonable compensation.
Yeah, that's a very clear answer you've given us, and you really make me aware of how abrupt he was in his wrong turn, I think, as you correctly put it. What was, in a rough sense, Richard, the magnitude of our interest at that time? I mean, I don't expect an exact statistic, but were we extremely active in Cuba's economy at the point that Castro took over, moderately so, or what?
American business was very prominent in Cuba's economy. It was the largest single foreign source of investment and Western capital. The assets that were expropriated by the Cuban government are valued at approximately $1.5 billion.
Wow.
For an economy of the size of Cuba's, that was a very substantial amount, and even by today's standards would be quite significant.
Mm.
The reaction in the U.S., of course, was quite strong, and it has actually grown in intensity, if anything.
Exactly.
That is, the relationship on a political level between the Cuban government and the American government has steadily deteriorated as Castro initially lined himself up with the Soviet Union. And if you go back to the early 60s, that was really the high point of Soviet prominence and success, coming off a decade of rapid economic growth in the Soviet Union, major technological breakthroughs through its military displays of power with
right.
the missiles and satellites and its space probes and so on. And there was a real challenge among the communist states to the West, which of course was being led by the United States.
Let's focus now on just what the Soviet interest in Cuba in particular was in this period, because I think, as you have pointed out, the Soviet Union did feel itself in a very intense sense of competition with the West. It was at a very strong point in its own economy, and it, I guess, effectively replaced the American business interests that were booted out of Cuba by Castro. Now, to what extent does the Soviet Union begin to dominate Cuba's economy, and with what result in the sort of early 1960s?
There was more or less complete substitution of the Soviet Union for the role that was formerly played by the United States. The U.S. had been the largest market for Cuban exports. It was a prominent purchaser of sugar and other agricultural and the small industry products from Cuba. It provided Cuba with energy. Much of the properties that were expropriated were U.S. Oil refineries. There was a major oil and a chemical complex owned by American business. So in terms of, and there was a very substantial tourist trade from the United States and many other kinds of business interests.
So in every sector, the Soviet Union essentially replaces the United States in the Cuban economy.
It does almost uniformly. It became the largest importer of Cuban sugar, the largest source of energy for Cuba.
Let's probe that a bit, Richard, because I think this is fundamentally important to us. Is it not the case that there's always been an extraordinarily marked political dimension to the Cuban economy, in the sense that it was kind of used as a showcase? I mean, the Russians were clearly doing this to make a point, I guess, to the Third World. And then perhaps even after the demise of the Soviet Union, Castro might have felt compelled to kind of maintain artificial relationships to make political points to his economy.
That's right. And the political benefits that the Soviet Union was getting out of its outpost in the Western Hemisphere, just 90 miles from the shores of Florida, were worth a lot to the Soviet Union. And that's why it's very hard to calculate in dollar terms exactly what the relationship was. For example, Cuba sent military forces to Angola and to other places to help communist insurgencies. And Cuba's military forces were a kind of a proxy for the Soviet Union. Soviet yeah. Union never sent military forces into some of these countries, but there were Cuban soldiers on the ground and Cuban weapons, many of which had been supplied by the Soviet Union. And by the way, one of the benefits that the Soviet Union provided to Cuba was military assistance.
Right.
It provided them with weapons and aircraft and other kinds of military hardware at very low cost.
Mm-hmm.
It also used Cuba as a military base.
That's right.
There were Soviet troops in Cuba and Soviet military establishments, and of course this led to the well-known Cuban missile crisis of the early 1960s.
That's right, which is still riveted in my memory, I'm sure in yours as well. I think that your designation, your characterization of Cuba as an outpost of the Soviet Union is very accurate indeed. I think that was what their perceived benefit was. As we move our story ahead in time, Richard, there's a very interesting period. I'd love to get your views on it. Seems to me that there was in fact a period of growth in the Cuban economy that was quite substantial. If we look at the period from roughly the late 70s until about the mid-1980s or thereabouts, I think it would be very helpful if you'd tell us why and to what extent there was growth in the Cuban economy.
There was significant growth. There had been some growth in the 1960s. It was a kind of an up-and-down situation in that decade. And then in the late 60s and the early 70s, growth resumed and was fairly sustained throughout the 1970s into the early 80s, as you say. Now, a lot of this was because of Soviet support, and also the support of the East European countries, which we haven't mentioned yet. Mm-hmm. But much of Cuba's sugar crop went to the East European countries, and the East European countries exported to Cuba a lot of machinery and a lot of equipment and products that Cuba could not have purchased elsewhere because of its shortage of hard currency. Right. It did not have the dollars. It had sugar, and it had some other agricultural crops and some small amounts of minerals that it could export. Mm-hmm. And by the way, one of the other benefits that Cuba got from the Soviet Union was in the deliveries of oil to Cuba. It more than met Cuba's energy requirements, leaving a surplus of oil that Cuba was able to re-export on the world market for hard currency, right, which allowed it to purchase some things that it did need from Western countries. These were good times for Cuba, largely because it was benefiting from the Soviet Union and from the East European communist states, who were helping to keep Cuba afloat and more than afloat.
One of the points I think that you also made concerning this period, or at least perhaps the latter portion of it, was that Castro also initiated some market reforms internally?
Yes, the economy in the early 80s went into a kind of a two-track system, where there was the state-controlled, state-managed, state-planned system that had been installed early in Castro's tenure. But he then engaged in a number of market reforms, allowing some private transactions on the farms. Farmers were allowed to sell some of their crops. Small businesses, retail outlets were allowed in the cities. And a kind of a thriving second economy was instituted.
That means like a small capitalism?
Yes, it was. Exactly. And the Cubans, of course, had worked under a capitalist system all of their history up until Castro. And so they were able to adapt rather quickly to their new found freedoms to engage in small-scale commercial transactions. Unfortunately, Castro abruptly terminated this whole experiment in about 1985.
Well, now you bring us exactly to a very pivotal point I want to ask you about. Against this sort of remarkable period, Richard, of the market reforms, of the small-scale, in quotes, capitalism in the interior and so forth, when things seem to be moving ahead, or at least looking more promising, more like the economies outside of Cuba, to be blunt about it, he does pull it back. The year 1986, I think, is a year you've identified as pivotal for understanding the course of things from then till now. And I think the Cuban word for what happened was rectification, which essentially is throwing all that out, which is in itself a question. I mean, why?
Yeah. Well, there's a moral undertone in that word. Castro felt that this experiment in private enterprise had gone too far and really contradicted his egalitarian socialist principles. There was some abuses, there always are, of black marketeering and profiteering and price gouging that went on. Castro magnified those out of proportion and used these abuses as a rationale for simply terminating, in Soviet style, I might say, by an edict, a process that had been going on and in overall rather successfully for a number of years. And he claimed that the situation had gotten out of hand and needed to be rectified. And so he instituted his rectification program.
You know, I don't want to try to inveigle you into petty psychological reading of tea leaves and that kind of thing, Richard, but as you said that, one thing that occurred to me is that's a striking example to me of the man's inflexibility. I mean, the degree to which he might be wedded to old forms and not really as adaptable as leaders in today's changing world almost, I think, have to be.
Castro, as I see him, started out as an idealist, and he had egalitarian principles of which he tried to institute. He was offended by the harsh dictatorship of the previous regime. He really did seem to have a feel for popular needs and popular sufferings. But his idealism turned into a rigid commitment to an ideology that really was foreign to his own historic traditions, and which he clung to even after the originators of that ideology abandoned it. And it's a curious historic coincidence, and maybe not so coincidental, that his program of rectification and his swing, his hard swing back towards a rigid state control occurred precisely at the time when the Soviet Union was abandoning that system, because Gorbachev first came into power in 1985, and by 1986 was advocating his own reforms of perestroika and glasnost for the Soviet Union, and was turning in the opposite direction.
That's true. You know, much of what we're talking about, practically all of it really, is based upon the intelligence that our countries gathered one way or another, and then your particular analysis of that intelligence. So I guess a question at this point clearly is just how good has that been? I mean, you alluded earlier to some of the problems in trying to assess trends in Cuba, but how good is the intelligence generally?
Not very good, partly because of a lack of commitment of resources. If you look back throughout most of the history of Castro's Cuba, it coincides with much of the history of the Cold War. Our concerns were absorbed by the Soviet Union. Our intelligence resources were devoted to the Soviet Union primarily. Cuba, because it aligns itself with the Soviet Union, falls between all the cracks of international monitoring. The U.S. is almost obsessed with knowing what goes on in the Soviet Union, wants to know everything that goes on in the Soviet Union, and devotes most of its intelligence resources to that end. Cuba is not a member of any of the international Western institutions such as the World Bank or the International Monetary Fund, obviously the OECD, which looks at other aspects of economic trends in various countries. And so none of these institutions are taking a hard, careful look at what's going on in Cuba. The United Nations does some economic reporting, but because of the political situation in the UN, it doesn't try to challenge Cuban official statistics, which are very misleading and very inadequate, and at best reports what the Cuban government wants the world to know about Cuba. And so there's almost no source of an accurate, in-depth, systematic review of what's taking place in Cuba.
Lots more to talk to you about, Richard. I want to bring our story from the mid-80s right up to today and what even tomorrow might look like. But before we do that, though, let me take a moment just to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of PRI, Public Radio International. I'm George Liston, CA, and my guest today is Richard Kaufman, a fellow of the Woodrow Wilson Center, where he's currently working on economic intelligence and Cold War policy. Richard Kaufman is former general counsel to the Joint Economic Committee of the U.S. Congress, and he was educated at the University of Texas. Well, as you mentioned, Richard, the late 1980s are extremely important to our story, largely because of what's happening elsewhere as the Soviet Union and East Europe undergo their own momentous change, and that has to be obviously devastating for Cuba. So maybe you could sort of quickly tell us what the immediate Cuban response to that cataclysmic change was in terms of its economy.
politically, Castro was shocked and offended and aghast at what was going on in the Soviet Union. And in the end, there were harsh words between he and Gorbachev. He basically condemned Gorbachev's efforts to reform the Soviet Union and recommitted himself to the principles of communism and central planning. Now, we can speculate, as we tried to earlier, about the effects of the rectification program and what the modest experiment in private markets may have contributed and may have done when they were pulled out of from under the Cuban economy. But the real shock to the Cuban economy occurred when the break began between Cuba and the Soviet Union, as well as Eastern Europe. All of that economic assistance and all of those economic benefits implied in the trade relationships were basically reduced dramatically during the period of the late 1980s.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that comes to my mind, actually from reading your reports on this, is that with his penchant for kind of socialist rhetoric, Castro declares this, does he not, a, quote, special period in peacetime. I mean, that he begins to turn the Cuban economy very strongly in the direction of austerity.
Exactly.
Because of this.
Exactly. That special period in peacetime was a euphemism for tightening belts and battening down the hatches and reversing much of the progress that had been made in Cuba in the prior 20 years or so. Mm-hmm. Cuba had become modestly urbanized, for one thing, and some industry was expanded in the major cities. All of this was turned back by Castro's response to the Soviet Union's perestroika. He even began sending people out of the cities back to the rural areas. For one thing, the cities could no longer support them. The energy shortages, the lack of transportation, the lack of electricity for industries and business in Havana and other cities made it almost inhabitable for many people. And he encouraged a return to the rural areas, the less populated and the agricultural areas.
How bad did things get, Richard? For example, in terms of food production, import substitution, those kinds of variables. How bad did things get for them?
Things have gotten very bad in economic terms, as best as they can be measured. Western estimates by those who attempt to make them indicate a fall in Cuba's economy by about 50%.
Wow.
Since a peak of sometime in the mid to late 1980s, and most of that has occurred since about 1989. Now, recently, although some people have challenged this view as being wildly pessimistic, a Cuban official, a very high Cuban official, visiting in London, acknowledged that there had been a drop of their gross domestic product of from 30% to 35% in the past several years. So I think the view of Western observers has been more or less confirmed now by Cuban government officials.
It would seem so. Clearly, one of the things that they would try to do, and I suppose they very much tried to do, to counter this would be to seek new trading partners as things sort of collapse around them. Do you have a sense of how they've been able to go about that, or its mitigating effect on any of this?
Yes, they have reached out. Let me mention one other point, though, that offsets the impression of the fall in economic production as best as we can measure it. One of Cuba's major assets, and one which a lot of people overlook, is its climate and its agricultural capacity. It has a modest, very habitable climate. You also have a very fertile country and one that is able to support itself at least agriculturally.
Richard, to conclude a conversation that I think has been illuminating, and is quite frankly illuminating in terms of your grasp of the history and the current aspects of this issue, I'd like to bring something I haven't mentioned into our conversation. That's the American embargo against Cuba. And let me phrase the question this way. As I suggested at the outset, there are very few communist states left in the world. Cuba, China, North Korea come to mind. And it seems to me that in our dealings, our American dealings with these countries, we're using very different routes. With China, for example, the recent controversy over most favored nation and trade suggests the argument there seems to be by keeping that trade tie, we can influence their transition toward democracy, which is our fondest hope, I would suspect. In terms of Cuba, we must, I'm sure, have the same wish, but clearly we've used a very different route, i.e. the embargo. And so as someone who spent a good portion of his life looking at these kinds of things and thinking about them, do you have a kind of a personal opinion about what might be the preferred route or the better route, or are we doing the right thing in terms of Cuba and in terms of influencing what inevitably will be a transition, perhaps even in this decade in that country?
Unhappily, the relations between the two countries, the U.S. and Cuba, became highly personalized with Castro's posturing and thumbing his nose at the U.S., which, of course, is a popular pastime in much of Latin America and throughout the world, and it's quite understandable. But he went over the line when he invited Soviet missiles into his country aimed at the United States. And in that sense, the U.S. Reaction was quite understandable. But the Cold War is over, and I don't think we have to worry anymore about Soviet missiles or Soviet military threats coming from Cuba. And Cuba no longer is a military threat to the United States. I do think we need to take a new look at our policies towards Cuba, especially, as you point out, in light of our policies towards China, which is also a communist country, and other policies around the world. It may still be hard for many of our own political leaders to try to live or even converse civilly with Castro, and we do have an extra problem, which is a very difficult one and has to be recognized, and that is a very large population of Cuban emigres in the United States who are committed to the overthrow of Castro or to his replacement through one means or another, many of whom would like to return to Cuba, and who put pressures on our own political process and our members of Congress and President and all others involved in the political process. So it would be very difficult to change our policy in a major way. But I do think that we ought to be thinking more of our own national interests here, and a review and a fresh look at Cuba is now becoming overdue.
Well, Richard Kaufman, thank you very much for a very fresh look at Cuba that you've given us today on Dialogue.
Well, thank you, George.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Richard Kaufman, former General Counsel to the Joint Economic Committee of the United States Congress. I'm George Liston, CA, producer and host of Dialogue. Assistant producer is Dennis Saunier, and our technical director is John Tyler. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in association with Radio Smithsonian. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For a cassette copy of this program, or for more information, call the Radio Store at 1-800-747-7444. That's 1-800-747-7444.